What Maisie knew. I. The child was provided for, but the new arrangement was inevitably confounding to a young intelligence intensely aware that something had happened which must matter a good deal and looking anxiously out for the effects of so great a cause. It was to be the fate of this patient little girl to see much more than she at first understood, but also even at first to understand much more than any little girl, however patient, had perhaps ever understood before. Only a drummer boy in a ballad or a story could have been so in the thick of the fight. She was taken into the confidence of passions on which she fixed just the stare she might have had for images bounding across the wall in the sight of a magic lantern. Her little world was phantasmagoric strange shadows dancing on a sheet. It was as if the whole performance had been given for her a mite of a half-scared infant in a great dim theater. She was in short introduced to life with a liberality in which the selfishness of others found its account, and there was nothing to avert the sacrifice but the modesty of her youth. Her first term was with her father, who spared her only in not letting her have the wild letters addressed to her by her mother. He confined himself to holding them up at her and shaking them, while he showed his teeth, and then amusing her by the way he chucked them, across the room, bang into the fire. Even at that moment, however, she had a scared anticipation of fatigue, a guilty sense of not rising to the occasion, feeling the charm of the violence with which the stiff unopened envelopes, whose big monograms Ida bristled with monograms she would have liked to see, were made to whiz, like dangerous missiles, through the air. The greatest effect of the great cause was her own greater importance, chiefly revealed to her in the larger freedom with which she was handled, pulled hither and thither and kissed, and the proportionately greater niceness she was obliged to show. Her features had somehow become prominent, they were so perpetually nipped by the gentleman who came to see her father and the smoke of whose cigarettes went into her face. Some of these gentlemen made her strike matches and light their cigarettes, others, holding her on knees violently jolted, pinched the calves of her legs till she shrieked. Her shriek was much admired and reproached them with being toothpicks. The word stuck in her mind and contributed to her feeling from this time that she was deficient in something that would meet the general desire. She found out what it was a congenital tendency to the production of a substance to which model, her nurse, gave a short ugly name, a name painfully associated at dinner with the part of the joint that she didn't like. She had left behind her the time when she had no desires to meet, none at least save models, who, in Kensington Gardens, was always on the bench when she came back to see if she had been playing too far. Model's desire was merely that she shouldn't do that, and she met it so easily that the only spots in that long brightness were the moments of her wondering what would become of her if, on her rushing back, there should be no model on the bench. They still went to the gardens, but there was a difference even there. She was impelled perpetually to look at the legs of other children and ask her nurse if they were toothpicks. Model was terribly truthful. She always said, "Oh my dear, you'll not find such another pair as your own." It seemed to have to do with something else that Model often said, "You feel the strain, that's where it is, and you'll feel it still worse, you know." Thus from the first Maisie not only felt it, but knew she felt it. A part of it was the consequence of her father's telling her he felt it too, and telling Model, in her presence, that she must make a point of driving that home. She was familiar, at the age of 6, with the fact that everything had been changed on her account, everything ordered to enable him to give himself up to her. She was to remember always the words in which Model impressed upon her that he did so give himself, "Your papa wishes you never to forget, you know, that he has been dreadfully put about." If the skin on Model's face had to Maisie the air of being unduly, almost painfully, stretched, it never presented that appearance so much as when she uttered, as she often had occasion to utter, such words. The child wondered if they didn't make it hurt more than usual, but it was only after some time that she was able to attach to the picture of her father's sufferings, and more particularly to her nurse's manner about them, the meaning for which these things had waited. By the time she had grown sharper, as the gentleman who had criticized her calves used to say, she found in her mind a collection of images and echoes to which meanings were attachable, images and echoes kept for her in the childish dusk, the dim closet, the high drawers, like games she wasn't yet big enough to play. The great strain meanwhile was that of carrying by the right end the things her father said about her mother, things mostly indeed that Model, on a glimpse of them, as if they had been complicated toys or difficult books, took out of her hands and put away in the closet. A wonderful assortment of objects of this kind she was to discover there later, all tumbled up too with the things, shuffled into the same receptacle, that her mother had said about her father. She had the knowledge that on a certain occasion which every day brought nearer her mother would be at the door to take her away, and this would have darkened all the days if the ingenious Model hadn't written on a paper in very big easy words ever so many pleasures that she would enjoy at the other house. These promises ranged from a mother's fond love to a nice poached egg to your tea, and took by the way the prospect of sitting up ever so late to see the lady in question dressed, in silks and velvets and diamonds and pearls, to go out, so that it was a real support to Maisie, at the supreme hour, to feel how, by Model's direction, the paper was thrust away in her pocket and there clenched in her fist. The supreme hour was to furnish her with a vivid reminiscence, that of a strange outbreak in the drawing room on the part of Model, who, in reply to something her father had just said, cried aloud, "You ought to be perfectly ashamed of yourself, you ought to blush, sir, for the way you go on." The carriage, with her mother in it, was at the door. A gentleman who was there, who was always there, laughed out very loud. Her father, who had her in his arms, said to Model, "My dear woman, I'll settle you presently." After which he repeated, showing his teeth more than ever at Maisie while he hugged her, the words for which her nurse had taken him up. Maisie was not at the moment so fully conscious of them as of the wonder of Model's sudden disrespect and crimson face, but she was able to produce them in the course of 5 minutes when, in the carriage, her mother, all kisses, ribbons, eyes, arms, strange sounds and sweet smells, said to her, "And did your beastly papa, my precious angel, send any message to your own loving mama?" Then it was that she found the words spoken by her beastly papa to be, after all, in her little bewildered ears, from which, at her mother's appeal, they passed, in her clear shrill voice, straight to her little innocent lips. "He said I was to tell you, from him," she faithfully reported, "that you're a nasty horrid pig, too." In that lively sense of the immediate which is the very air of a child's mind, the past, on each occasion, became for her as indistinct as the future. She surrendered herself to the actual with a good faith that might have been touching to either parent. Crudely as they had calculated, they were at first justified by the event. She was the little feathered shuttlecock they could fiercely keep flying between them. The evil they had the gift of thinking or pretending to think of each other they poured into her little gravely gazing soul as into a boundless receptacle, and each of them had doubtless the best conscience in the world as to the duty of teaching her the stern truth that should be her safeguard against the other. She was at the age for which all stories are true and all conceptions are stories. The actual was the absolute, the present alone was vivid. The objurgation, for instance, launched in the carriage by her mother after she had at her father's bidding punctually performed, was a missive that dropped into her memory with the dry rattle of a letter falling into a pillar box. Like the letter it was, as part of the contents of a well-stuffed postbag, delivered in due course at the right address. In the presence of these overflowings, after they had continued for a couple of years, the associates of either party sometimes felt that something should be done for what they called the real good, don't you know? Of the child. The only thing done, however, in general, took place when it was sighingly remarked that she fortunately wasn't all the year round where she happened to be at the awkward moment, and that, furthermore, either from extreme cunning or from extreme stupidity, she appeared not to take things in. The theory of her stupidity, eventually embraced by her parents, corresponded with a great date in her small still life, the complete vision, private but final, of the strange office she filled. It was literally a moral revolution and accomplished in the depths of her nature. The stiff dolls on the dusky shelves began to move their arms and legs, old forms and phrases began to have a sense that frightened her. She had a new feeling, the feeling of danger, on which a new remedy rose to meet it, the idea of an inner self or, in other words, of concealment. She puzzled out with imperfect signs, but with a prodigious spirit, that she had been a center of hatred and a messenger of insult, and that everything was bad because she had been employed to make it so. Her parted lips locked themselves with the determination to be employed no longer. She would forget everything, she would repeat nothing, and when, as a tribute to the successful application of her system, she began to be called a little idiot, she tasted a pleasure new and keen. When therefore, as she grew older, her parents in turn announced before her that she had grown shockingly dull, it was not from any real contraction of her little stream of life. She spoiled their fun, but she practically added to her own. She saw more and more, she saw too much. It was Miss Overmore, her first governess, who on a momentous occasion had sown the seeds of secrecy, sown them not by anything she said, but by a mere roll of those fine eyes which Maisie already admired. Model had become at this time, after alternations of residence of which the child had no clear record, an image faintly embalmed in the remembrance of hungry disappearances from the nursery and distressful lapses in the alphabet, sad embarrassments, in particular, when invited to recognize something her nurse described as the important letter H. Miss Overmore, however hungry, never disappeared. This marked her somehow as of higher rank, and the character was confirmed by a prettiness that Maisie supposed to be extraordinary. Mrs. Farange had described her as almost too pretty, and someone had asked what that mattered so long as Beale wasn't there. Beale or no Beale, Maisie had heard her mother reply, "I take her because she's a lady and yet awfully poor. Rather nice people, but there are seven sisters at home. What do people mean? Maisie didn't know what people meant, but she knew very soon all the names of all the sisters. She could say them off better than she could say the multiplication table. She privately wondered, moreover, though she never asked, about the awful poverty, of which her companion also never spoke. Food at any rate came up by mysterious laws. Miss Overmore never, like Model, had on an apron, and when she ate she held her fork with her little finger curled out. The child, who watched her at many moments, watched her particularly at that one. "I think you're lovely," she often said to her. Even Mama, who was lovely too, had not such a pretty way with the fork. Maisie associated this showier presence with her now being big, knowing of course that nursery governesses were only for little girls who were not, as she said, really little. She vaguely knew, further, somehow, that the future was still bigger than she, and that a part of what made it so was the number of governesses lurking in it and ready to dart out. Everything that had happened when she was really little was dormant, everything but the positive certitude, bequeathed from afar by Model, that the natural way for a child to have her parents was separate and successive, like her mutton and her pudding or her bath and her nap. "Does he know he lies?" That was what she had vivaciously asked Miss Overmore on the occasion which was so suddenly to lead to a change in her life. "Does he know?" Miss Overmore stared. She had a stocking pulled over her hand and was pricking at it with a needle which she poised in the act. Her task was homely, but her movement, like all her movements, graceful. "Why, Papa? That he lies? That's what Mama says. I'm to tell him that he lies and he knows he lies." Miss Overmore turned very red, though she laughed out till her head fell back, then she pricked again at her muffled hand so hard that Maisie wondered how she could bear it. "Am I to tell him?" the child went on. It was then that her companion addressed her in the unmistakable language of a pair of eyes of deep dark gray. "I can't say no," they replied as distinctly as possible. "I can't say no, because I'm afraid of your Mama, don't you see? Yet how can I say yes after your Papa has been so kind to me, talking to me so long the other day, smiling and flashing his beautiful teeth at me the time we met him in the park, the time when, rejoicing at the sight of us, he left the gentleman he was with and turned and walked with us, stayed with us for half an hour." Somehow in the light of Miss Overmore's lovely eyes that incident came back to Maisie with a charm it hadn't had at the time, and this in spite of the fact that after it was over her governess had never but once alluded to it. On their way home, when Papa had quitted them, she had expressed the hope that the child wouldn't mention it to Mama. Maisie liked her so, and had so the charmed sense of being liked by her, that she accepted this remark as settling the matter and wonderingly conformed to it. The wonder now lived again, lived in the recollection of what Papa had said to Miss Overmore, "I've only to look at you to see you're a person I can appeal to for help to save my daughter." Maisie's ignorance of what she was to be saved from didn't diminish the pleasure of the thought that Miss Overmore was saving her. It seemed to make them cling together as in some wild game of going round. 3. She was therefore all the more startled when her mother said to her in connection with something to be done before her next migration, "You understand of course that she's not going with you." Maisie turned quite faint. "Oh, I thought she was." "It doesn't in the least matter, you know, what you think," Mrs. Farange loudly replied, "and you had better indeed for the future, miss, learn to keep your thoughts to yourself." This was exactly what Maisie had already learned, and the accomplishment was just the source of her mother's irritation. It was of a horrid little critical system, a tendency, in her silence, to judge her elders, that this lady suspected her, liking as she did, for her own part, a child to be simple and confiding. She liked also to hear the report of the wax she administered to Mr. Farange's character, to his pretensions to peace of mind, the satisfaction of dealing them diminished when nothing came back. The day was at hand, and she saw it, when she should feel more delight in hurling Maisie at him than in snatching her away, so much so that her conscience winced under the acuteness of a candid friend who had remarked that the real end of all their tugging would be that each parent would try to make the little girl a burden to the other, a sort of game in which a fond mother clearly wouldn't show to advantage. The prospect of not showing to advantage, a distinction in which she held she had never failed, begot in Ida Farange an ill humor of which several persons felt the effect. She determined that Beadle at any rate should feel it. She reflected afresh that in the study of how to be odious to him she must never give way. Nothing could incommode him more than not to get the good, for the child, of a nice female appendage who had clearly taken a fancy to her. One of the things Ida said to the appendage was that Beale's was a house in which no decent woman could consent to be seen. It was Miss Overmore herself who explained to Maisie that she had had a hope of being allowed to accompany her to her father's, and that this hope had been dashed by the way her mother took it. "She says that if I ever do such a thing as enter his service I must never expect to show my face in this house again. So I promise not to attempt to go with you. If I wait patiently till you come back here we shall certainly be together once more." Waiting patiently, and above all waiting till she should come back there, seemed to Maisie a long way round. It reminded her of all the things she had been told, first and last, that she should have if she'd be good, and that in spite of her goodness she had never had at all. Then who'll take care of me at Papa's? Heaven only knows, my own precious. Miss Overmore replied, tenderly embracing her. There was indeed no doubt that she was dear to this beautiful friend. What could have proved it better than the fact that before a week was out, in spite of their distressing separation and her mother's prohibition and Miss Overmore's scruples and Miss Overmore's promise, the beautiful friend had turned up at her father's. The little lady already engaged there to come by the hour, a fat dark little lady with a foreign name and dirty fingers, who wore, throughout, a bonnet that had at first given her a deceptive air, too soon dispelled, of not staying long, besides asking her pupil questions that had nothing to do with lessons, questions that Beale Farange himself, when two or three were repeated to him, admitted to be awfully low. This strange apparition faded before the bright creature who had braved everything for Maisie's sake. The bright creature told her little charge frankly what had happened, that she had really been unable to hold out. She had broken her vow to Mrs. Farange, she had struggled for 3 days and then had come straight to Maisie's papa and told him the simple truth. She adored his daughter, she couldn't give her up, she'd make for her any sacrifice. On this basis it had been arranged that she should stay, her courage had been rewarded, she left Maisie in no doubt as to the amount of courage she had required. Some of the things she said made a particular impression on the child, her declaration for instance that when her pupil should get older she'd understand better just how dreadfully bold a young lady, to do exactly what she had done, had to be. Fortunately your papa appreciates it, he appreciates it immensely - that was one of the things Miss Overmore also said, with a striking insistence on the adverb. Maisie herself was no less impressed with what this martyr had gone through, especially after hearing of the terrible letter that had come from Mrs. Farange. Mama had been so angry that, in Miss Overmore's own words, she had loaded her with insult, proof enough indeed that they must never look forward to being together again under Mama's roof. Mama's roof, however, had its turn, this time, for the child, of appearing but remotely contingent, so that, to reassure her, there was scarce a need of her companion's secret, solemnly confided the probability there would be no going back to Mama at all. It was Miss Overmore's private conviction, and a part of the same communication, that if Mr. Farange's daughter would only show a really marked preference she would be backed up by public opinion in holding onto him. Poor Maisie could scarcely grasp that incentive, but she could surrender herself to the day. She had conceived her first passion, and the object of it was her governess. It hadn't been put to her, and she couldn't, or at any rate she didn't, put it to herself, that she liked Miss Overmore better than she liked Papa, but it would have sustained her under such an imputation to feel herself able to reply that Papa too liked Miss Overmore exactly as much. He had particularly told her so. Besides she could easily see it, for all this led her on, but it brought on her fate as well, the day when her mother would be at the door in the carriage in which Maisie now rode on no occasions but these. There was no question at present of Miss Overmore's going back with her. It was universally recognized that her quarrel with Mrs. Farange was much too acute. The child felt it from the first. There was no hugging nor exclaiming as that lady drove her away. There was only a frightening silence, unenlivened even by the invidious inquiries of former years, which culminated, according to its stern nature, in a still more frightening old woman, a figure awaiting her on the very doorstep. "You're to be under this lady's care," said her mother. "Take her, Mrs. Wicks," she added, addressing the figure impatiently and giving the child a push from which Maisie gathered that she wished to set Mrs. Wicks an example of energy. Mrs. Wicks took her and, Maisie felt the next day, would never let her go. She had struck her at first, just after Miss Overmore, as terrible, but something in her voice at the end of an hour touched the little girl in a spot that had never even yet been reached. Maisie knew later what it was, though doubtless she couldn't have made a statement of it. These were things that a few days' talk with Mrs. Wicks quite lighted up. The principal one was a matter Mrs. Wicks herself always immediately mentioned. She had had a little girl quite of her own, and the little girl had been killed on the spot. She had had absolutely nothing else in all the world, and her affliction had broken her heart. It was comfortably established between them that Mrs. Wicks's heart was broken. What Maisie felt was that she had been, with passion and anguish, a mother, and that this was something Miss Overmore was not, something, strangely, confusingly, that Mama was even less. So it was that in the course of an extraordinarily short time she found herself as deeply absorbed in the image of the little dead Claire Matilda, who, on a crossing in the Harrow Road, had been knocked down and crushed by the cruelest of hansoms, as she had ever found herself in the family group made vivid by one of seven. "She's your little dead sister," Mrs. Wicks ended by saying, and Maisie, all in a tremor of curiosity and compassion, addressed from that moment a particular piety to the small accepted acquisition. Somehow she wasn't a real sister, but that only made her the more romantic. It contributed to this view of her that she was never to be spoken of in that character to anyone else, least of all to Mrs. Farange, who wouldn't care for her nor recognize the relationship. It was to be just an unutterable and inexhaustible little secret with Mrs. Wicks. Maisie knew everything about her that could be known, everything she had said or done in her little mutilated life, exactly how lovely she was, exactly how her hair was curled and her frocks were trimmed. Her hair came down far below her waist. It was of the most wonderful golden brightness, just as Mrs. Wicks's own had been a long time before. Mrs. Wicks's own was indeed very remarkable still, and Maisie had felt at first that she should never get on with it. It played a large part in the sad and strange appearance, the appearances of a kind of greasy grayness, which Mrs. Wicks had presented on the child's arrival. It had originally been yellow, but time had turned that elegance to ashes, to a turbid sallow and venerable white. Still excessively abundant, it was dressed in a manner of which the poor lady appeared not yet to have recognized the supersession, with a glossy braid, like a large diadem, on the top of the head, and behind, at the nape of the neck, a dingy rosette like a large button. She wore glasses which, in humble reference to a divergent obliquity of vision, she called her straighteners, and a little ugly snuff-colored dress trimmed with satin bands in the form of scallops and glazed with antiquity. The straighteners, she explained to Maisie, were put on for the sake of others, whom, as she believed, they helped to recognize the bearing, otherwise doubtful, of her regard. The rest of the melancholy garb could only have been put on for herself. With the added suggestion of her goggles, it reminded her pupil of the polished shell or corselet of a horrid beetle. At first she had looked cross and almost cruel, but this impression passed away with the child's increased perception of her being in the eyes of the world a figure mainly to laugh at. She was as droll as a charade or an animal toward the end of a natural history, a person whom people, to make talk lively, described to each other and imitated. Everyone knew the straighteners, everyone knew the diadem and the button, the scallops and satin bands, everyone, though Maisie had never betrayed her, knew even Claire and Matilda. It was on account of these things that Mama got her for such low pay, really for nothing, so much. One day when Mrs. Wicks had accompanied her into the drawing-room and left her, the child heard one of the ladies she found there, a lady with eyebrows arched like skipping ropes and thick black stitching, like ruled lines for musical notes on beautiful white gloves, announced to another. She knew governesses were poor, Miss Overmore was unmentionably and Mrs. Wicks ever so publicly so. Neither this, however, nor the old brown frock nor the diadem nor the button, made a difference for Maisie in the charm put forth through everything, the charm of Mrs. Wicks's conveying that somehow, in her ugliness and her poverty, she was peculiarly and soothingly safe, safer than anyone in the world, than Papa, than Mama, than the lady with the arched eyebrows, safer even, though so much less beautiful, than Miss Overmore, on whose loveliness, as she supposed it, the little girl was faintly conscious that one couldn't rest with quite the same tucked in and kissed for goodnight feeling. Mrs. Wicks was as safe as Clara Matilda, who was in heaven and yet, embarrassingly, also in Kensal Green, where they had been together to see her little huddled grave. It was from something in Mrs. Wicks's tone, which in spite of caricature remained indescribable and inimitable, that Maisie, before her term with her mother was over, drew this sense of a support, like a breast-high banister in a place of drops, that would never give way. If she knew her instructress was poor and queer, she also knew she was not nearly so qualified as Miss Overmore, who could say lots of dates straight off, letting you hold the book yourself, state the position of Malabar, play six pieces without notes and, in a sketch, put in beautifully the trees and houses and difficult parts. Maisie herself could play more pieces than Mrs. Wicks, who was moreover visibly ashamed of her houses and trees and could only, with the help of a smutty forefinger, of doubtful legitimacy in the field of art, do the smoke coming out of the chimneys. They dealt, the governess and her pupil, in subjects, but there were many the governess put off from week to week and that they never got to at all. She only used to say, "We'll take that in its proper order." Her order was a circle as vast as the untraveled globe. She had not the spirit of adventure. The child could perfectly see how many subjects she was afraid of. She took refuge on the firm ground of fiction, through which indeed there curled the blue river of truth. She knew swarms of stories, mostly those of the novels she had read, relating them with a memory that never faltered and a wealth of detail that was Maisie's delight. They were all about love and beauty and countesses and wickedness. Her conversation was practically an endless narrative, a great garden of romance, with sudden vistas into her own life and gushing fountains of homeliness. These were the parts where they most lingered. She made the child take with her again every step of her long, limb course and think it beyond magic or monsters. Her pupil acquired a vivid vision of everyone who had ever, In her phrase, knocked against her some of them oh so hard. Everyone literally but Mr. Wicks, her husband, as to whom nothing was mentioned save that he had been dead for ages. He had been rather remarkably absent from his wife's career, and Maisie was never taken to see his grave.
V.
The second parting from Miss Overmore had been bad enough, but this first parting from Mrs. Wicks was much worse. The child had lately been to the dentist and had a term of comparison for the screwed-up intensity of the scene. It was dreadfully silent, as it had been when her tooth was taken out. Mrs. Wicks had on that occasion grabbed her hand and they had clung to each other with the frenzy of their determination not to scream. Maisie, at the dentist's, had been heroically still, but just when she felt most anguish had become aware of an audible shriek on the part of her companion, a spasm of stifled sympathy. This was reproduced by the only sound that broke their supreme embrace when, a month later, the arrangement, as her periodical uprootings were called, played the part of the horrible forceps. Embedded in Mrs. Wicks's nature as her tooth had been socketed in her gum, the operation of extracting her would really have been a case for chloroform. It was a hug that fortunately left nothing to say, for the poor woman's want of words at such an hour seemed to fall in with her want of everything. Maisie's alternate parent, in the outermost vestibule he liked the impertinence of crossing as much as that of his late wife's threshold, stood over them with his open watch and his still more open grin, while from the only corner of an eye on which something of Mrs. Wicks's didn't impinge the child saw at the door a brougham in which Miss Overmore also waited. She remembered the difference when, 6 months before, she had been torn from the breast of that more spirited protectress. Miss Overmore, then also in the vestibule, but of course in the other one, had been thoroughly audible and voluble. Her protest had rung out bravely and she had declared that something her pupil didn't know exactly what was a regular wicked shame. That had at the time dimly recalled to Maisie the faraway moment of Model's great outbreak. There seemed always to be shames connected in one way or another with her migrations. At present, while Mrs. Wicks's arms tightened and the smell of her hair was strong, she further remembered how, in pacifying Miss Overmore, Papa had made use of the words "you dear old duck." An expression which, by its oddity, had stuck fast in her young mind, having moreover a place well prepared for it there by what she knew of the governess whom she now always mentally characterized as the pretty one. She wondered whether this affection would be as great as before. That would at all events be the case with the prettiness Maisie could see in the face which showed brightly at the window of the brougham. The brougham was a token of harmony, of the fine conditions Papa would this time offer. He had usually come for her in a hansom, with a four-wheeler behind for the boxes. The four-wheeler with the boxes on it was actually there. But Mama was the only lady with whom she had ever been in a conveyance of the kind always of old spoken of by Model as a private carriage. Papa's carriage was, now that he had won, still more private, somehow, than Mama's, and when at last she found herself quite on top, as she felt, of its inmates and gloriously rolling away, she put to Miss Overmore, after another immense and talkative squeeze, a question of which the motive was a desire for information as to the continuity of a certain sentiment. "Did Papa like you just the same while I was gone?" she inquired, full of the sense of how markedly his favor had been established in her presence. She had bethought herself that this favor might, like her presence and as if depending on it, be only intermittent and for the season. Papa, on whose knee she sat, burst into one of those loud laughs of his that, however prepared she was, seemed always, like some trick in a frightening game, to leap forth and make her jump. Before Miss Overmore could speak he replied, "Why, you little donkey, when you're away what have I left to do but just to love her?" Miss Overmore hereupon immediately took her from him, and they had a merry little scrimmage over her of which Maisie caught the surprised perception in the white stare of an old lady who passed in a victoria. Then her beautiful friend remarked to her very gravely, "I shall make him understand that if he ever again says anything as horrid as that to you I shall carry you straight off and we'll go and live somewhere together and be good quiet little girls." The child couldn't quite make out why her father's speech had been horrid, since it only expressed that appreciation which their companion herself had of old described as immense. To enter more into the truth of the matter she appealed to him again directly, asked if in all those months Miss Overmore hadn't been with him just as she had been before and just as she would be now. "Of course she has, old girl, where else could the poor dear be?" cried Beale Ferrange, to the still greater scandal of their companion, who protested that unless he straightway took back his nasty wicked fib it would be, this time, not only him she would leave, but his child too and his house and his tiresome trouble, all the impossible things he had succeeded in putting on her. Beale, under this frolic menace, took nothing back at all. He was indeed apparently on the point of repeating his extravagance, but Miss Overmore instructed her little charge that she was not to listen to his bad jokes. She was to understand that a lady couldn't stay with a gentleman that way without some awfully proper reason. Maisie looked from one of her companions to the other. This was the freshest, gayest start she had yet enjoyed, but she had a shy fear of not exactly believing them. Well, what reason is proper? She thoughtfully demanded. Oh, a long-legged stick of a tomboy, there's none so good as that. Her father enjoyed both her drollery and his own and tried again to get possession of her, an effort deprecated by their comrade and leading again to something of a public scuffle. Miss Overmore declared to the child that she had been all the while with good friends, on which Beale Farange went on, "She means good friends of mine, you know, tremendous friends of mine. There has been no end of them about that, I will say for her." Maisie felt bewildered and was afterwards for some time conscious of a vagueness, just slightly embarrassing, as to the subject of so much amusement and as to where her governess had really been. She didn't feel at all as if she had been seriously told, and no such feeling was supplied by anything that occurred later. Her embarrassment, of a precocious instinctive order, attached itself to the idea that this was another of the matters it was not for her, as her mother used to say, to go into. Therefore, under her father's roof during the time that followed, she made no attempt to clear up her ambiguity by an ingratiating way with housemaids, and it was an odd truth that the ambiguity itself took nothing from the fresh pleasure promised her by renewed contact with Miss Overmore. The confidence looked for by that young lady was of the fine sort that explanation can improve, and she herself at any rate was a person superior to any confusion. For Maisie, moreover, concealment had never necessarily seemed deception. She had grown up among things as to which her foremost knowledge was that she was never to ask about them. It was far from new to her that the questions of the small are the peculiar diversion of the great. Except the affairs of her doll Lisette, there had scarcely ever been anything at her mother's that was explicable with a grave face. Nothing was so easy to her as to send the ladies who gathered there off into shrieks, and she might have practiced upon them largely if she had been of a more calculating turn. Everything had something behind it. Life was like a long, long corridor with rows of closed doors. She had learned that at these doors it was wise not to knock. This seemed to produce from within such sounds of derision. Little by little, however, she understood more, for it befell that she was enlightened by Lisette's questions, which reproduced the effect of her own upon those for whom she sat in the very darkness of Lisette. Was she not herself convulsed by such innocence? In the presence of it she often imitated the shrieking ladies. There were at any rate things she really couldn't tell even a French doll. She could only pass on her lessons and study to produce on Lisette the impression of having mysteries in her life, wondering the while whether she succeeded in the air of shading off, like her mother, into the unknowable. When the reign of Miss Overmore followed that of Mrs. Wicks, she took a fresh cue, emulating her governess and bridging over the interval with the simple expectation of trust. Yes, there were matters one couldn't go into with a pupil. There were, for instance, days when, after prolonged absence, Lisette, watching her take off her things, tried hard to discover where she had been. Well, she discovered a little, but never discovered all. There was an occasion when, on her being particularly indiscreet, Maisie replied to her and precisely about the motive of a disappearance as she, Maisie, had once been replied to by Mrs. Farange, "Find out for yourself." She mimicked her mother's sharpness, but she was rather ashamed afterwards, though as to whether of the sharpness or of the mimicry was not quite clear. She became aware in time that this phase wouldn't have shown by lessons, the care of her education being now only one of the many duties devolving on Miss Overmore, a devolution as to which she was present at various passages between that lady and her father, passages significant, on either side, of dissent and even of displeasure. It was gathered by the child on these occasions that there was something in the situation for which her mother might come down on them all, though indeed the remark, always dropped by her father, was greeted on his companion's part with direct contradiction. Such scenes were usually brought to a climax by Miss Overmore's demanding, with more asperity than she applied to any other subject, in what position under the sun such a person as Mrs. Farange would find herself for coming down. As the months went on, the little girl's interpretations thickened, and the more effectually that this stretch was the longest she had known without a break. She got used to the idea that her mother, for some reason, was in no hurry to reinstate her. That idea was forcibly expressed by her father whenever Miss Overmore, differing and decided, took him up on the question, which he was always putting forward, of the urgency of sending her to school. For a governess, Miss Overmore differed surprisingly, far more, for instance, than would have entered into the bowed head of Mrs. Wicks. She observed to Maisie many times that she was quite conscious of not doing her justice, and that Mr. Farange equally measured and equally lamented this deficiency. The reason of it was that she had mysterious responsibilities that interfered responsibilities, Miss Overmore intimated, to Mr. Farange himself and to the friendly noisy little house and those who came there. Mr. Farange's remedy for every inconvenience was that the child should be put at school. There were such lots of splendid schools, as everybody knew, at Brighton and all over the place. That, however, Maisie learned, was just what would bring her mother down, From the moment he should delegate to others the housing of his little charge, he hadn't a leg to stand on before the law. Didn't he keep her away from her mother precisely because Mrs. Farange was one of these others? There was also the solution of a second governess, a young person to come in by the day and really do the work, but to this Miss Overmore wouldn't for a moment listen, arguing against it with great public relish and wanting to know from all comers. She put it even to Maisie herself, they didn't see how frightfully it would give her away. What am I supposed to be at all, don't you see, if I'm not here to look after her? She was in a false position and so freely and loudly called attention to it that it seemed to become almost a source of glory. The way out of it, of course, was just to do her plain duty, but that was unfortunately what, with his excessive, his exorbitant demands on her, which everyone indeed appeared quite to understand, he practically, he selfishly prevented. Beale Farange, for Miss Overmore, was now never anything but he, and the house was as full as ever of lively gentlemen with whom, under that designation, she chaffingly talked about him. Maisie meanwhile, as a subject of familiar gossip on what was to be done with her, was left so much to herself that she had hours of wistful thought of the large loose discipline of Mrs. Wicks, yet she nonetheless held it under her father's roof a point of superiority that none of his visitors were ladies. It added to this odd security that she had once heard a gentleman say to him, as if it were a great joke and in obvious reference to Miss Overmore, "Hanged if she'll let another woman come near you, hanged if she ever will. She'd let fly a stick at her as they do at a strange cat." Maisie greatly preferred gentlemen as inmates in spite of their also having their way louder but sooner over of laughing out at her. They pulled and pinched, they teased and tickled her, some of them even, as they termed it, shied things at her, and all of them thought it funny to call her by names having no resemblance to her own. The ladies on the other hand addressed her as "you poor pet" and scarcely touched her even to kiss her. But it was of the ladies she was most afraid. She was now old enough to understand how disproportionate a stay she had already made with her father, and also old enough to enter a little into the ambiguity attending the success, which oppressed her particularly whenever the question had been touched upon in talk with her governess. "Oh, you needn't worry, she doesn't care," Miss Overmore had often said to her in reference to any fear that her mother might resent her prolonged detention. "She has other people than poor little you to think about, and has gone abroad with them, so you needn't be in the least afraid she'll stickle this time for her rights." Maisie knew Mrs. Farange had gone abroad, for she had had weeks and weeks before a letter from her beginning "my precious pet" and taking leave of her for an indeterminate time, but she had not seen in it a renunciation of hatred or of the writer's policy of asserting herself, for the sharpest of all her impressions had been that there was nothing her mother would ever care so much about as to torment Mr. Farange. What at last, however, was in this connection bewildering and a little frightening was the dawn of a suspicion that a better way had been found to torment Mr. Farange than to deprive him of his periodical burden. This was the question that worried our young lady and that Miss Overmore's confidences and the frequent observations of her employer only rendered more mystifying. It was a contradiction that if Ida had now a fancy for waiving the rights she had originally been so hot about, her late husband shouldn't jump at the monopoly for which he had also in the first instance so fiercely fought. But when Maisie, with a subtlety beyond her years, sounded this new ground, her main success was in hearing her mother more freshly abused. Miss Overmore had up to now rarely deviated from a decent reserve. But the day came when she expressed herself with a vividness not inferior to Beale's own on the subject of the lady who had fled to the continent to wriggle out of her job. It would serve this lady right, Maisie gathered, if that contract, in the shape of an overgrown and underdressed daughter, should be shipped straight out to her and landed at her feet in the midst of scandalous excesses. The picture of these pursuits was what Miss Overmore took refuge in when the child tried timidly to ascertain if her father were disposed to feel he had too much of her. She evaded the point and only kicked up all round at the dust of Ida's heartlessness and folly, of which the supreme proof, it appeared, was the fact that she was accompanied on her journey by a gentleman whom, to be painfully plain on it, she had well, picked up. The terms on which, unless they were married, ladies and gentlemen might, as Miss Overmore expressed it, knock about together, were the terms on which she and Mr. Farange had exposed themselves to possible misconception. She had indeed, as has been noted, often explained this before, often said to Maisie, "I don't know what in the world, darling, your father and I should do without you, for you just make the difference, as I've told you, of keeping us perfectly proper." The child took in the office it was so endearingly presented to her that she performed a comfort that helped her to a sense of security even in the event of her mother's giving her up. Familiar as she had grown with the fact of the great alternative to the proper, she felt in her governess and her father a strong reason for not emulating that detachment. At the same time she had heard somehow of little girls of exalted rank, it was true, whose education was carried on by instructors of the other sex, and she knew that if she were at school at Brighton it would be thought an advantage to her to be more or less in the hands of masters. She turned these things over and remarked to Miss Overmore that if she should go to her mother, perhaps the gentleman might become her tutor. The gentleman? The proposition was complicated enough to make Miss Overmore stare. The one who's with Mama. Mightn't that make it right as your being my governess makes it for you to be with Papa? Miss Overmore considered, she colored a little, then she embraced her ingenious friend. You're too sweet. I'm a real governess. And couldn't he be a real tutor? Of course not. He's ignorant and bad. Bad? Maisie echoed with wonder. Her companion gave a queer little laugh at her tone. He's ever so much younger, but that was all. Younger than you? Miss Overmore laughed again. It was the first time Maisie had seen her approach so nearly to a giggle. Younger than no matter whom. I don't know anything about him and don't want to, she rather inconsequently added. He's not my sort, and I'm sure, my own darling, he's not yours. And she repeated the free caress into which her colloquies with Maisie almost always broke and which made the child feel that her affection at least was a gauge of safety. Parents had come to seem vague, but governesses were evidently to be trusted. Maisie's faith in Mrs. Wicks, for instance, had suffered no lapse from the fact that all communication with her had temporarily dropped. During the first weeks of their separation, Clara Matilda's mama had repeatedly and dolefully written to her, and Maisie had answered with an enthusiasm controlled only by orthographical doubts, but the correspondence had been duly submitted to Miss Overmore, with the final effect of its not suiting her. It was this lady's view that Mr. Farange wouldn't care for it at all, and she ended by confessing, since her pupil pushed her, that she didn't care for it herself. She was furiously jealous, she said, and that weakness was but a new proof of her disinterested affection. She pronounced Mrs. Wicks's effusions, moreover, illiterate and unprofitable. She made no scruple of declaring it monstrous that a woman in her senses should have placed the formation of her daughter's mind in such ridiculous hands. Maisie was well aware that the proprietress of the old brown dress and the old odd headgear was lower in the scale of form than Miss Overmore, but it was now brought home to her with pain that she was educationally quite out of the question. She was buried for the time beneath a conclusive remark of her critics, "She's really beyond a joke." This remark was made as that charming woman held in her hand the last letter that Maisie was to receive from Mrs. Wicks. It was fortified by a decree proscribing the preposterous tie. "Must I then write and tell her?" the child bewilderedly asked. She grew pale at the dreadful things it appeared involved for her to say. "Don't dream of it, my dear, I'll write, you may trust me," cried Miss Overmore, who indeed wrote to such purpose that a hush in which you could have heard a pin drop descended upon poor Mrs. Wicks. She gave for weeks and weeks no sign whatever of life. It was as if she had been as effectually disposed of by Miss Overmore's communication as her little girl, in the Harrow Road, had been disposed of by the terrible hansom. Her very silence became after this one of the largest elements of Maisie's consciousness. It proved a warm and habitable air, into which the child penetrated further than she dared ever to mention to her companions. Somewhere in the depths of it the dim straighteners were fixed upon her. Somewhere out of the troubled little current Mrs. Wicks intensely waited. 7. It quite fell in with this intensity that one day, on returning from a walk with the housemaid, Maisie should have found her in the hall, seated on the stool usually occupied by the telegraph boys who haunted Beale Farange's door and kicked their heels while, in his room, answers to their missives took form with the aid of smoke puffs and growls. It had seemed to her on their parting that Mrs. Wicks had reached the last limits of the squeeze, but she now felt those limits to be transcended and that the duration of her visitor's hug was a direct reply to Miss Overmore's veto. She understood in a flash how the visit had come to be possible, that Mrs. Wicks, watching her chance, must have slipped in under protection of the fact that Papa, always tormented in spite of arguments with the idea of a school, had, for a 3 days' excursion to Brighton, absolutely insisted on the attendance of her adversary. It was true that when Maisie explained their absence and their important motive, Mrs. Wicks wore an expression so peculiar that it could only have had its origin in surprise. This contradiction indeed peeped out only to vanish. For at the very moment that, in the spirit of it, she threw herself afresh upon her young friend, a hansom crested with neat luggage rattled up to the door and Miss Overmore bounded out. The shock of her encounter with Mrs. Wicks was less violent than Maisie had feared on seeing her and didn't at all interfere with the sociable tone in which, under her rival's eyes, she explained to her little charge that she had returned, for a particular reason, a day sooner than she first intended. She had left Papa in such nice lodgings at Brighton, but he would come back to his dear little home on the morrow. As for Mrs. Wicks, Papa's companion supplied Maisie in later converse with the right word for the attitude of this personage. Mrs. Wicks stood up to her in a manner that the child herself felt at the time to be astonishing. This occurred indeed after Miss Overmore had so far raised her interdict as to make a move to the dining room, where, In the absence of any suggestion of sitting down, it was scarcely more than natural that even poor Mrs. Wicks should stand up. Maisie at once inquired if at Brighton, this time, anything had come of the possibility of a school, to which, much to her surprise, Miss Overmore, who had always grandly repudiated it, replied after an instant, but quite as if Mrs. Wicks were not there. "It may be, darling, that something will come. The objection, I must tell you, has been quite removed." At this it was still more startling to hear Mrs. Wicks speak out with great firmness. "I don't think, if you'll allow me to say so, that there's any arrangement by which the objection can be removed. What has brought me here today is that I've a message for Maisie from dear Mrs. Farange." The child's heart gave a great thump. "Oh, Mama's come back?" "Not yet, sweet love, but she's coming," said Mrs. Wicks, "and she has most thoughtfully, you know, sent me on to prepare you."
"To prepare her for what, pray?" asked Miss Overmore, whose first smoothness began, with this news, to be ruffled.
Mrs. Wicks quietly applied her straighteners to Miss Overmore's flushed beauty. "Well, miss, for a very important communication."
"Can't dear Mrs. Farange, as you so oddly call her, make her communications directly? Can't she take the trouble to write to her only daughter?" the younger lady demanded. "Maisie herself will tell you that it's months and months since she has had so much as a word from her."
"Oh, but I've written to Mama," cried the child as if this would do quite as well.
"That makes her treatment of you all the greater scandal," the governess in possession promptly declared.
"Mrs. Farange is too well aware," said Mrs. Wicks with sustained spirit, "of what becomes of her letters in this house." Maisie's sense of fairness hereupon interposed for her visitor. "You know, Miss Overmore, that Papa doesn't like everything of Mama's."
"No one likes, my dear, to be made the subject of such language as your mother's letters contain. They were not fit for the innocent child to see," Miss Overmore observed to Mrs. Wicks.
"Then I don't know what you complain of, and she's better without them. It serves every purpose that I'm in Mrs. Farange's confidence."
Miss Overmore gave a scornful laugh. "Then you must be mixed up with some extraordinary proceedings."
"None so extraordinary," cried Mrs. Wicks, turning very pale, "as to say horrible things about the mother to the face of the helpless daughter."
"Things not a bit more horrible, I think," Miss Overmore returned, "than those you, madam, appear to have come here to say about the father."
Mrs. Wicks looked for a moment hard at Maisie, and then, turning again to this witness, spoke with a trembling voice. "I came to say nothing about him, and you must excuse Mrs. Farange and me if we're not so above all reproaches the companion of his travels." The young woman thus described stared at the apparent breadth of the description she needed a moment to take it in. Maisie, however, gazing solemnly from one of the disputants to the other, noted that her answer, when it came, perched upon smiling lips.
"It will do quite as well, no doubt, if you come up to the requirements of the companion of Mrs. Farange's."
Mrs. Wicks broke into a queer laugh. It sounded to Maisie an unsuccessful imitation of a neigh.
"That's just what I'm here to make known, how perfectly the poor lady comes up to them herself." She held up her head at the child.
"You must take your mama's message, Maisie, and you must feel that her wishing me to come to you with it this way is a great proof of interest and affection. She sends you her particular love and announces to you that she's engaged to be married to Sir Claude."
"Sir Claude?"
Maisie wonderingly echoed. But while Mrs. Wicks explained that this gentleman was a dear friend of Mrs. Farange's, who had been of great assistance to her in getting to Florence and in making herself comfortable there for the winter, she was not too violently shaken to perceive her old friend's enjoyment of the effect of this news on Miss Overmore. That young lady opened her eyes very wide. She immediately remarked that Mrs. Farange's marriage would of course put an end to any further pretension to take her daughter back. Mrs. Wicks inquired with astonishment why it should do anything of the sort, and Miss Overmore gave as an instant reason that it was clearly but another dodge in a system of dodges. She wanted to get out of the bargain. Why else had she now left Maisie on her father's hands weeks and weeks beyond the time about which she had originally made such a fuss? It was vain for Mrs. Wicks to represent, as she speciously proceeded to do, that all this time would be made up as soon as Mrs. Farange returned. She, Miss Overmore, knew nothing, thank heaven, about her confederate, but was very sure any person capable of forming that sort of relation with the lady in Florence would easily agree to object to the presence in his house of the fruit of a union that his dignity must ignore. It was a game like another, and Mrs. Wicks's visit was clearly the first move in it. Maisie found in this exchange of asperities a fresh incitement to the unformulated fatalism in which her sense of her own career had long since taken refuge, and it was the beginning for her of a deeper prevision that, in spite of Miss Overmore's brilliancy and Mrs. Wicks's passion,
She should live to see a change in the nature of the struggle she appeared to have come into the world to produce. It would still be essentially a struggle, but its object would now be not to receive her. Mrs. Wicks, after Miss Overmore's last demonstration, addressed herself wholly to the little girl, and, drawing from the pocket of her dingy old pelisse a small flat parcel, removed its envelope and wished to know if that looked like a gentleman who wouldn't be nice to everybody, let alone to a person he would be so sure to find so nice. Mrs. Farange, in the candor of newfound happiness, had enclosed a cabinet photograph of Sir Claude, and Maisie lost herself in admiration of the fair smooth face, the regular features, the kind eyes, the amiable air, the general glossiness and smartness of her prospective stepfather, only vaguely puzzled to suppose herself now with two fathers at once. Her researches had hitherto indicated that to incur a second parent of the same sex you had usually to lose the first. Isn't he sympathetic? Asked Mrs. Wicks, who had clearly, on the strength of his charming portrait, made up her mind that Sir Claude promised her a future. You can see, I hope, she added with much expression, that he's a perfect gentleman. Maisie had never before heard the word sympathetic applied to anybody's face. She heard it with pleasure, and from that moment it agreeably remained with her. She testified moreover to the force of her own perception in a small soft sigh of response to the pleasant eyes that seemed to seek her acquaintance, to speak to her directly. He's quite lovely, she declared to Mrs. Wicks. Then eagerly, irrepressibly, as she still held the photograph and Sir Claude continued to fraternize, oh, can't I keep it? She broke out. No sooner had she done so than she looked up from it at Miss Overmore. This was with the sudden instinct of appealing to the authority that had long ago impressed on her that she mustn't ask for things. Miss Overmore, to her surprise, looked distant and rather odd, hesitating and giving her time to turn again to Mrs. Wicks. Then Maisie saw that lady's long face lengthen. It was stricken and almost scared, as if her young friend really expected more of her than she had to give. The photograph was a possession that, direly denuded, she clung to, and there was a momentary struggle between her fond clutch of it and her capability of every sacrifice for her precarious pupil. With the acuteness of her years, however, Maisie saw that her own avidity would triumph, and she held out the picture to Miss Overmore as if she were quite proud of her mother. "Isn't he just lovely?" she demanded, while poor Mrs. Wicks hungrily wavered, her straighteners largely covering it and her pelisse gathered about her with an intensity that strained its ancient seams. "It was to me, darling," the visitor said, "that your mama so generously sent it, but of course if it would give you particular pleasure," she faltered, only gasping her surrender. Miss Overmore continued extremely remote. "If the photograph's your property, my dear, I shall be happy to oblige you by looking at it on some future occasion. But you must excuse me if I decline to touch an object belonging to Mrs. Wicks." That lady had by this time grown very red. "You might as well see him this way, miss," she retorted, "as you certainly never will, I believe, in any other. Keep the pretty picture, by all means, my precious," she went on. "Sir Claude will be happy himself, I dare say, to give me one with a kind inscription." The pathetic quaver of this brave boast was not lost on Maisie, who threw herself so gratefully on the speaker's neck that, when they had concluded their embrace, the public tenderness of which, she felt, made up for the sacrifice she imposed, their companion had time to lay a quick hand on Sir Claude and, with a glance at him or not, whisk him effectually out of sight. Released from the child's arms, Mrs. Wicks looked about for the picture, then she fixed Miss Overmore with a hard dumb stare, and finally, with her eyes on the little girl again, achieved the grimmest of smiles. "Well, nothing matters, Maisie, because there's another thing your mama wrote about. She has made sure of me." Even after her loyal hug, Maisie felt a bit of a sneak as she glanced at Miss Overmore for permission to understand this. But Mrs. Wicks left them in no doubt of what it meant. "She has definitely engaged me for her return and for yours. Then you'll see for yourself." Maisie, on the spot, quite believed she should, but the prospect was suddenly thrown into confusion by an extraordinary demonstration from Miss Overmore. "Mrs. Wicks," said that young lady, "has some undiscoverable reason for regarding your mother's hold on you as strengthened by the fact that she's about to marry. I wonder then in that system what our visitor will say to your father's." Miss Overmore's words were directed to her pupil, but her face, lighted with an irony that made it prettier even than ever before, was presented to the dingy figure that had stiffened itself for departure. The child's discipline had been bewildering, had ranged freely between the prescription that she was to answer when spoken to and the experience of lively penalties on obeying that prescription. This time, nevertheless, she felt emboldened for risks, above all as something portentous seemed to have leapt into her sense of the relations of things. She looked at Miss Overmore much as she had a way of looking at persons who treated her to grown-up jokes. Do you mean Papa's hold on mate, or you mean he's about to marry?
Papa's not about to marry. Papa is married, my dear. Papa was married the day before yesterday at Brighton. Miss Overmore glittered more gaily, meanwhile it came over Maisie, and quite dazzlingly, that her smart governess was a bride. He's my husband, if you please, and I'm his little wife. So now we'll see who's your little mother. She caught her pupil to her bosom in a manner that was not to be outdone by the emissary of her predecessor, and a few moments later, when things had lurched back into their places, that poor lady, quite defeated of the last word, had soundlessly taken flight.
8. After Mrs. Wicks's retreat, Miss Overmore appeared to recognize that she was not exactly in a position to denounce Ida Farrange's second union, but she drew from a table drawer the photograph of Sir Claude and, standing there before Maisie, studied it at some length.
"Isn't he beautiful?" the child ingenuously asked. Her companion hesitated.
"No, he's horrid," she, to Maisie's surprise, sharply returned. But she debated another minute, after which she handed back the picture. It appeared to Maisie herself to exhibit a fresh attraction, and she was troubled, having never before had occasion to differ from her lovely friend. So she only could ask what, such being the case, she should do with it. Should she put it quite away where it wouldn't be there to offend? On this Miss Overmore again cast about, after which she said unexpectedly, "Put it on the schoolroom mantelpiece." Maisie felt a fear. "Won't Papa dislike to see it there?"
"Very much indeed, but that won't matter now." Miss Overmore spoke with peculiar significance and to her pupil's mystification.
"On account of the marriage?" Maisie risked. Miss Overmore laughed, and Maisie could see that in spite of the irritation produced by Mrs. Wicks she was in high spirits.
"Which marriage do you mean?" With the question put to her it suddenly struck the child she didn't know, so that she felt she looked foolish. So she took refuge in saying, "Shall you be different?" This was a full implication that the bride of Sir Claude would be.
"As your father's wedded wife?"
"Utterly,"
Miss Overmore replied. And the difference began of course in her being addressed, even by Maisie, from that day and by her particular request, as Mrs. Beale. It was there indeed principally that it ended, for except that the child could reflect that she should presently have four parents in all, and also that at the end of 3 months the staircase, for a little girl hanging over banisters, sent up the deepening rustle of more elaborate advances, everything made the same impression as before. Mrs. Beale had very pretty frocks, but Miss Overmore's had been quite as good, and if Papa was much fonder of his second wife than he had been of his first, Maisie had foreseen that fondness, had followed its development almost as closely as the person more directly involved. There was little indeed in the commerce of her companions that her precocious experience couldn't explain, for if they struck her as after all rather deficient in that air of the honeymoon of which she had so often heard in much detail, for instance, from Mrs. Wicks it was natural to judge the circumstance in the light of Papa's proved disposition to contest the empire of the matrimonial tie. His honeymoon, when he came back from Brighton not on the morrow of Mrs. Wicks's visit, and not, oddly, till several days later, his honeymoon was perhaps perceptibly tinged with the dawn of a later stage of wedlock. There were things dislike of which, as the child knew it, wouldn't matter to Mrs. Beale now, and their number increased so that such a trifle as his hostility to the photograph of Sir Claude quite dropped out of view. This pleasing object found a conspicuous place in the schoolroom, which in truth Mr. Farrange seldom entered and in which silent admiration formed, during the time I speak of, almost the sole scholastic exercise of Mrs. Beale's pupil. Maisie was not long in seeing just what her stepmother had meant by the difference she should show in her new character. If she was her father's wife she was not her own governess, and if her presence had had formerly to be made regular by the theory of a humble function she was now on a footing that dispensed with all theories and was inconsistent with all servitude. That was what she had meant by the drop of the objection to a school. Her small companion was no longer required at home, as it was Mrs. Beale's own amusing word, a little duenna. The argument against a successor to Miss Overmore remained. It was composed frankly of the fact, of which Mrs. Beale granted the full absurdity, that she was too awfully fond of her stepdaughter to bring herself to see her in vulgar and mercenary hands. The note of this particular danger emboldened Maisie to put in a word for Mrs. Wicks, the modest measure of whose avidity she had taken from the first, but Mrs. Beale disposed afresh and effectually of a candidate who would be sure to act in some horrible and insidious way for Ida's interest and who moreover was personally loathsome and as ignorant as a fish. She made also no more of a secret of the awkward fact that a good school would be hideously expensive, and of the further circumstance, which seemed to put an end to everything, that when it came to the point Papa, in spite of his previous clamor, was really most nasty about paying. "Would you believe," Mrs. Beale confidentially asked of her little charge, "that he says I'm a worse expense than ever, and that a daughter and a wife together are really more than he can afford? It was thus that the splendid school at Brighton lost itself in the haze of larger questions, though the fear that it would provoke Ida to leap into the breach subsided with her prolonged, her quite shameless non-appearance. Her daughter and her successor were therefore left to gaze in united but helpless blankness at all Maisie was not learning. This quantity was so great as to fill the child's days with a sense of intermission to which even French Lisette gave no accent, with finished games and unanswered questions and dreaded tests, with the habit, above all, in her watch for a change, of hanging over banisters when the doorbell sounded. This was the great refuge of her impatience, but what she heard at such times was a clatter of gaiety downstairs, the impression of which, from earliest childhood, had built up in her the belief that the grown-up time was the time of real amusement and above all of real intimacy. Even Lisette, even Mrs. Wicks had never, she felt, in spite of hugs and tears, been so intimate with her as so many persons at present were with Mrs. Beale and as so many others of old had been with Mrs. Farange. The note of hilarity brought people together still more than the note of melancholy, which was the one exclusively sounded, for instance, by poor Mrs. Wicks. Maisie in these days preferred nonetheless that domestic revels should be wafted to her from a distance. She felt sadly unsupported for facing the inquisition of the drawing-room. That was a reason the more for making the most of Susan Ash, who in her quality of under-housemaid moved at a very different level and who, nonetheless, was much dependent upon out-of-doors. She was a guide to peregrinations that had little in common with those intensely definite airings that had left with the child a vivid memory of the regulated mind of Model. There had been under Model's system no dawdles at shop windows and no nudges, in Oxford Street, of I say, look at her. There had been an inexorable treatment of crossings and a serene exemption from the fear that especially at corners, of which she was yet weakly fond, haunted the housemaid, the fear of being, as she ominously said, spoken to. The dangers of the town equally with its diversions added to Maisie's sense of being untutored and unclaimed. The situation, however, had taken a twist when, on another of her returns, at Susan's side, extremely tired, from the pursuit of exercise qualified by much harboring, she encountered another emotion. She on this occasion learned at the door that her instant attendance was requested in the drawing-room. Crossing the threshold in a cloud of shame, she discerned through the blur Mrs. Beale seated there with a gentleman who immediately drew the pain from her predicament by rising before her as the original of the photograph of Sir Claude. She felt the moment she looked at him that he was by far the most shining presence that had ever made her gape, and her pleasure in seeing him, in knowing that he took hold of her and kissed her, as quickly throbbed into a strange shy pride in him, a perception of his making up for her fallen state, for Susan's public nudges, which quite bruised her, and for all the lessons that, in the dead schoolroom, where at times she was almost afraid to stay alone, she was bored with not having. It was as if he had told her on the spot that he belonged to her, so that she could already show him off and see the effect he produced. No, nothing else that was most beautiful ever belonging to her could kindle that particular joy, not Mrs. Beale at that very moment, not Papa when he was gay, nor Mama when she was dressed, nor Lisette when she was new. The joy almost overflowed in tears when he laid his hand on her and drew her to him, telling her, with a smile of which the promise was as bright as that of a Christmas tree, that he knew her ever so well by her mother, but had come to see her now so that he might know her for himself. She could see that his view of this kind of knowledge was to make her come away with him, and, further, that it was just what he was there for and had already been some time, arranging it with Mrs. Beale and getting on with that lady in a manner evidently not at all affected by her having on the arrival of his portrait thought of him so ill. They had grown almost intimate or had the air of it over their discussion, and it was still further conveyed to Maisie that Mrs. Beale had made no secret, and would make yet less of one, of all that it cost to let her go. "You seem so tremendously eager," she said to the child, "that I hope you're at least clear about Sir Claude's relation to you. It doesn't appear to occur to him to give you the necessary reassurance." Maisie, a trifle mystified, turned quickly to her new friend. "Why, it's of course that you're married to her, isn't it?" Her anxious emphasis started them off, as she had learned to call it. This was the echo she infallibly and now quite resignedly produced. Moreover, Sir Claude's laughter was an indistinguishable part of the sweetness of his being there. "We've been married, my dear child, 3 months, and my interest in you is a consequence, don't you know? Of my great affection for your mother. In coming here it's of course for your mother I'm acting." "Oh, I know," Maisie said with all the candor of her competence. "She can't come herself except just to the door." Then as she thought afresh, "Can't she come even to the door now?" "There you are," Mrs. Beale exclaimed to Sir Claude. She spoke as if his dilemma were ludicrous. His kind face, in a hesitation, seemed to recognize it, but he answered the child with a frank smile. "No, not very well."
"Because she has married you?"
He promptly accepted this reason.
"Well, that has a good deal to do with it."
He was so delightful to talk to that Maisie pursued the subject. But Papa, he has married Miss Overmore. Ah, you'll see that he won't come for you at your mother's, that lady interposed.
Yes, but that won't be for a long time, Maisie hastened to respond.
We won't talk about it now, you've months and months to put in first. And Sir Claude drew her closer.
Oh, that's what makes it so hard to give her up. Mrs. Beale made this point with her arms out to her stepdaughter.
Maisie, quitting Sir Claude, went over to the man, clasped in a still tenderer embrace, felt entrancingly the extension of the field of happiness.
I'll come for you, said her stepmother, if Sir Claude keeps you too long, we must make him quite understand that.
Don't talk to me about her ladyship. She went on to their visitor so familiarly that it was almost as if they must have met before.
I know her ladyship as if I had made her.
They're a pretty pair of parents, cried Mrs. Beale.
Maisie had so often heard them called so that the remark diverted her but an instant from the agreeable wonder of this grand new form of allusion to her mother, and that, in its turn, presently left her free to catch at the pleasant possibility, in connection with herself, of a relation much happier as between Mrs. Beale and Sir Claude than as between Mama and Papa. Still, the next thing that happened was that her interest in such a relation brought to her lips a fresh question.
Have you seen Papa? She asked of Sir Claude.
It was the signal for their going off again, as her small stoicism had perfectly taken for granted that it would be. All that Mrs. Beale had nevertheless to add was the vague apparent sarcasm, "Oh, Papa.
I'm assured he's not at home," Sir Claude replied to the child, "but if he had been I should have hoped for the pleasure of seeing him."
"Won't he mind your coming?" Maisie asked as with need of the knowledge.
"Oh, you bad little girl," Mrs. Beale humorously protested.
The child could see that at this Sir Claude, though still moved to mirth, colored a little, but he spoke to her very kindly.
"That's just what I came to see, you know, whether your father would mind.
But Mrs. Beale appears strongly of the opinion that he won't."
This lady promptly justified that view to her stepdaughter. "It will be very interesting, my dear, you know, to find out what it is today that your father does mind.
I'm sure I don't know." And she seemed to repeat, though with perceptible resignation, her plaint of a moment before.
"Your father, darling, is a very odd person indeed." She turned with this, smiling, to Sir Claude.
"But perhaps it's hardly civil for me to say that of his not objecting to have you in the house. If you knew some of the people he does have."
Maisie knew them all, and none indeed were to be compared to Sir Claude.
He laughed back at Mrs. Beale. He looked at such moments quite as Mrs. Wicks, in the long stories she told her pupil, always described the lovers of her distressed beauties, the perfect gentleman and strikingly handsome. He got up, to the child's regret, as if he were going.
"Oh, I dare say we should be all right."
Mrs. Beale once more gathered in her little charge, holding her close and looking thoughtfully over her head at their visitor.
"It's so charming for a man of your type to have wanted her so much."
"What do you know about my type?" Sir Claude laughed.
"Whatever it may be, I dare say it deceives you. The truth about me is simply that I'm the most unappreciated of what do you call the fellows?
Family men.
Yes, I'm a family man. Upon my honor I am."
"Then why on earth," cried Mrs. Beale, "didn't you marry a family woman?"
Sir Claude looked at her hard.
"You know who one marries, I think. Besides, there are no family women hanged if there are. None of them want any children hanged if they do."
His account of the matter was most interesting, and Maisie, as if it were of bad omen for her, stared at the picture in some dismay. At the same time she felt, through encircling arms, her protectress hesitate.
"You do come out with things.
But you mean her ladyship doesn't want any really?"
"Won't hear of them simply.
But she can't help the one she has got."
And with this Sir Claude's eyes rested on the little girl in a way